Campaign 76. I'm Jed Duval, CBS News, reporting on the CBS radio network. With the Mondale campaign, leaving California and due back in less than a week. Coming back soon and often because Mondale feels, as he told a crowd in Los Angeles this morning, this state could decide the election. Yesterday, he was in East Los Angeles at a brand new and quite attractive housing project, where residents proudly gave him a slideshow, then took Mondale out in the yard to show off the roses, peppers, and other plants they're cultivating. This morning, breakfast with labor leaders, then Jewish leaders. Then a colorful rally with John Tunney, who's in a tough race for re-election to the U.S. Senate. Earlier, Mondale was in San Francisco, and next week he'll repeat that swing. Jimmy Carter, too, has been here and will be back to continue the quest for the nation's most populous state, the state where Carter lost in the primary to the governor, Jerry Brown. And there's an important factor, the young and sometimes politically perplexing governor. Was he angry after the Democratic convention nominated Carter? Did he go home to Sacramento to sulk? Would he stay out of the fight and maybe cost the Democrats the state? Walter Mondale was in Sacramento yesterday, was in Jerry Brown's office, and after a conference, the two emerged and grinning and talking up unity. Unity, they said it over and over. Yes, Brown would campaign for the ticket. An extensive campaign, was the way aides worded it. Many stops in the state and others beyond. Mondale later said he feels, as a result of the conversation with Brown, that the Californian is fully committed, will energetically support the ticket. There are other places to go, to labor conventions and picnics. Mondale has already visited several, indeed, is today before the large steelworkers convention in Las Vegas. In these situations, he is most at home. He played volleyball at one stop in Ohio. He talks up jobs, a stable dollar, health care, and ridicules the Republicans' handling of the economy. Some other settings Mondale considers challenges and seeks them out. He asked for and got a chance before the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco this week. It's a largely Republican club where his speech went uninterrupted with applause. What does he hope to accomplish? If not winning votes, Mondale says, I want to win respect as a serious candidate. As he puts it, I'd like them to see me, not accept some caricature. Campaign 76. I'm Jed Duval, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Carol Nelson reporting on the CBS radio network. In 1970, Lawton Childs stunned seasoned election viewers by conducting a walking campaign throughout the state to win the Florida Senate seat. Three Republicans will battle in Florida's primary Tuesday for the right to challenge Childs' first bid for re-election in November. Dr. John Grady, one of the contenders, ran an unsuccessful bid for the Senate in 1974 as an independent candidate, running against Republican Jack Eckert and Democrat Dick Stone, who won. Grady ran a surprisingly strong race. Supporters of Eckert charged that Grady's third-party candidacy divided the conservative vote and defeated their man. Eckert recently retired from politics after being appointed as director of the General Services Administration. The 45-year-old Grady is a former jet pilot who started practicing medicine, primarily obstetrics, in Belgrade, Florida, after hearing the town needed a doctor. He joined the John Birch Society and has spoken throughout the country on behalf of the American Party. To wage this race, Grady switched to the Republican Party. Grady's basing his campaign on the economy. The budget, he says, must be overhauled. Deficit spending must stop. Grady's principal opponent for the Republican nomination is Walter Sims. Sims prides himself on his organization, although he's never won a statewide race. Sims has served 6 years in the Florida legislature. His current stint in the Florida Senate will expire this year. The son of an Alabama sharecropper, Sims has been a successful realtor. Sims is portraying Grady in the campaign as a far-rightist who's influenced heavily by the anti-communist John Birch Society, while he presents himself as a moderate Republican. Although Sims campaigns on the issues of defense and foreign alliances, he labels Grady as a Johnny-come-lately to the Republican Party. He's particularly critical of Grady putting a $20,000 loan into his 1974 campaign and not disclosing the source. Democratic Senator Lawton Childs, who has no primary opposition, is widely regarded as a hands-down winner for re-election in November. The key is the crossover vote in a state where Democrats outnumber Republicans 2.5 to 1. Political analysts see this as a key race in characterizing the sentiment of the Republican voter this fall. Campaign 76. I'm Carol Nelson, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Robert Pierpoint, CBS News White House correspondent, reporting on the CBS radio network. Somewhat like a ship looming out of the fog, President Ford's campaign strategy for this fall is beginning to emerge from the mists. A still fuzzy outline, For reasons beyond the understanding of reporters covering the White House, President Ford's fall campaign plans have been as closely guarded a secret as a new model car in Detroit. But slowly the misty outlines are now forming into a structure, and this is what it looks like. During the month of September, the president will spend much of his time being presidential. That means Mr. Ford will stay in the White House, conspicuously handling the nation's domestic and foreign affairs. He'll also be meeting with various influential political groups from time to time. This week, for example, he received in the Oval Office the heads of the American Legion and the Catholic War veterans. Next week, he'll see the leaders of the B'nai B'rith, a Jewish group, and the Conference of Catholic Bishops. Meantime, Mr. Ford will be studying up for the first debate, a key factor in both the president's strategy and that of his opponent. At the same time, President Ford and his aides are already at work on a series of speeches to be delivered during the next month or so. The first one will be given on the campus of the University of Michigan week after next. And while Press Secretary Nissen went to some pains to avoid saying this would be Mr. Ford's campaign kickoff address, he called it just another out-of-town speech, other aides say that is what it amounts to. They explain that each one of these campaign speeches will be carefully drafted to contain both the president's past accomplishments in specific fields and will also lay out Mr. Ford's plans for the future if he wins the election. The theme of all this activity was enunciated by Nissen, who explained, "You have a president who has a record of 2 years of accomplishments. Do you want to keep him or replace the president with the other fellow?" And what if the polls seem to show that most voters still want to replace the president with the other fellow, Jimmy Carter by name, as they now do after a month of this strategy? Early in October, explains Nissen, we'll see where we stand and make a series of decisions, presumably on whether to stick to the current strategy or dump it and try something else. Campaign 76, I'm Robert Pierpoint, CBS News.
Campaign 76, I'm Jim Kohler reporting on the CBS Radio Network. Large numbers of voters aren't expected for the North Dakota primary, but there's election interest just the same. Incumbent Democratic Senator Quentin Burdick will have his strongest challenge this election year from Republican-endorsed State Senator Robert Strelp. But both men are looking over their shoulder, keeping an eye on a rather strong challenge by a third-party candidate. The American Party of North Dakota has qualified for ballot position and certified 31 candidates for state and local races. Clarence Haggard is the American Party candidate for the U.S. Senate seat, and he feels he has a chance at the job. Burdick points out that most of the attention will be on the measures. North Dakota has six constitutional measures on the primary ballot, plus an initiated measure to limit the spending of the state legislature, while Republican Straub says the primary is probably not going to be very revealing. However, Haggard says the primary definitely matters to the American Party. He says it's the first time the party will be on the ballot, and if some leadership can be shown, they'll do well in the general election. The American Party is making itself felt in the governor's race in North Dakota also. Democratic Governor Arthur Link foresees little chance of major political trends emerging from the 1976 primary, but adds he will be interested in the total number of votes cast as an indication of voter interest, and will be watching how many votes American Party candidate Martin Valor collects. Republican endorsed Richard Elkin has an independent Republican, Herb Geving, to dispose of in the primary, but he's looking to the general election in November as being so close as to need a recount. And he expects to lose some support to the American Party since it draws much of its support from ex-Republicans who are more conservative politically. Valor has come out with strong campaign statements, a tax cut in North Dakota, a pro-life statement, and against federal involvement in public schools. So the consensus is not a large number of votes cast in the North Dakota primary, but a great deal of interest where they go. It's not so much what candidate as what party will receive the votes in the North Dakota primary, and this year there's three to choose from. For Campaign 76, Jim Kohler, CBS News.
Campaign 76, I'm Sam Chulin reporting on the CBS Radio Network. It's primary day in four states, one of them Arizona.
It's Campaign 76, and Republicans from all over Arizona will soon be voting for their new United States Senator.
Sounds like a normal campaign, but on the Republican side, the Senate race has been a hot and dirty one. Both GOP Senate contenders are congressmen. Both are conservative. There's John Conlon, son of a baseball umpire, evangelical Christian. Conlon wears white loafers. Then there's Sam Steiger, former New Yorker turned Arizona rancher.
Steiger is Jewish and wears cowboy boots.
Our differences in style have been characterized as the scalpel versus the meat axe, with John referring to himself as the scalpel. I refer to him as more of a roto-rooter. It's been the dirtiest campaign I've ever been in, and I've been in eight of them in this state.
Conlon agrees, but he calls Steiger the dirty fighter.
He just has a different, rougher way of going about things, and I try and reason with people and try and be a gentleman in all my activities.
The contest has gotten down to name-calling. The Steiger camp charging Conlon is anti-Semitic.
John was consistently referring to me in audiences and in private as the New York Jew.
It's not true. I've got Jewish people in my campaign committee. I've got a Jewish press secretary, and I fly with a Jewish pilot. Now, if you're anti-Semitic, you don't have a Jewish pilot.
Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater joined the fray, charging Conlon with anti-Semitism, and then endorsing Steiger. Conlon doesn't like that.
The Steiger people fed this information to the senator, caught him in a weak moment, and got an endorsement statement out of him.
Retiring Senator Paul Fannin and the state's leading newspaper have also come out for Steiger. Conlon charges there's been backroom politicking. Steiger has charged Conlon with organizing a national political movement among right-wing Christians.
The Christian Freedom Foundation and the Christian Embassy and the Third Century Publishing House. John is involved with all of them, and several of those people have told me that they're interested in seeing John become President of the United States, and this is the way to do it.
Well, that's incorrect as far as the general implications of it. I happen to be a Christian. I do not believe that I have to abandon my faith in God and Christ in order to serve in public office.
Both agree this has been a bruising campaign for the party. But both say Arizona voters will still send another Republican to the Senate to fill the Senate seat left vacant by Paul Fannin.
He will go his way and I will go mine, and the party will heal. As I say, the best evidence of that's going to come on November 2nd, and I guess we'll just have to wait and demonstrate it to you.
The Republican candidate will face one of three Democrats vying in this primary race. State School Superintendent Carolyn Warner, Dennis DeConcini, a wealthy attorney, or former State Attorney General Wade Church, who's run his campaign on money, won in a libel suit. Campaign 76, Sam Chulin, CBS News, New York.
Campaign 76, I'm Don Cladstrip, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. 2 years ago today, a new president, Gerald R. Ford, pardoned former President Nixon for any crimes he may have committed in office. Mr. Ford said he wanted to put Watergate behind us. Today, morality in government is still an issue in Campaign 76. Both Mr. Ford and Jimmy Carter tell voters about their personal honesty in office. But is Watergate behind us? Richard Nixon is spending this second anniversary of his pardon sequestered at his San Clemente estate, out of public view. But it's hard to keep Mr. Nixon out of public mind, since he and other disgraced members of his administration have been in the news all during this campaign year. Just yesterday, a federal judge ordered former Nixon aide John Ehrlichman to begin serving time soon for his role in the plumber's break-in at Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office. More reminders of Watergate. In July, the Senate finally passed the so-called Watergate Reform Bill to prevent and prosecute wrongdoing in high government office. Earlier in the year, a panel of judges upheld the law giving the government, and not Mr. Nixon, control over his papers and tapes. Mr. Nixon was disbarred in New York. His former secretary, Rosemary Woods, won the return of her personal mementos from government custody. The Watergate cast of characters keeps popping in and out of news. But what about the theme running under the Watergate scandals, the agony the nation experienced over revelations of high crime and high office? Jimmy Carter has said in the past that he himself would never bring up Watergate, that the voters would resent it as a political ploy. But just yesterday in Pennsylvania, Carter struck his familiar morality theme, evoking an image of Richard Nixon, in Carter's words, lying, cheating, and leaving the highest office in disgrace. Carter's running mate, Senator Walter Mondale, regularly raises the Watergate issue on the campaign trail, asking the country to repudiate the party that was led by Richard Nixon. For his part, Mr. Ford says he doesn't think his pardon of Mr. Nixon will hurt him in November. In fact, says the president, he'd do it again for the good of the country. and the Ford team is hoping that the flap over charges that aides of running mate Robert Dole once took illegal campaign money from Gulf Oil will blow over now that those charges have been denied. It's hard to say how the voters will react to the morality issue when they go to the poll in November. The CBS News survey shows that supporters of Gerald Ford and of Jimmy Carter give their man high scores for honesty. And the survey shows that voters are split just about down the middle on whether the Nixon pardon was right or wrong. The morality issue is cropping up in local elections, too. Yesterday, Florida Democrat Robert Sykes won renomination to his House seat, even though Sykes has been reprimanded by the House for misusing a committee chairmanship for personal gain. In Utah, Congressman Alan Howe is seeking re-election in spite of his conviction for soliciting sex from decoy police prostitutes. 2 years after the Nixon pardon and the nominal end of the Watergate era, voters are still being asked to consider the question of morality in politics when they go to the polls. Campaign 76. I'm Don Cladstrip, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Neil Strauser, CBS News, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. Once in June, when his nomination seemed decided but the Republican race was still open, Jimmy Carter held a nearly 2-1 lead over President Ford. Now, as the fall campaign begins, his lead is down to about 4-3, and the undecideds again hold the balance. These are the findings of the latest CBS News New York Times survey of the electorate. Findings which point to a perhaps crucial role for the forthcoming presidential debates, with Carter apparently having the most to lose. During the week before Labor Day, CBS News and the New York Times interviewed 1,703 registered voters by telephone, the type of survey that generally has a sampling error of plus or minus 3%. What the voters told us was what generally had been expected and borne out by other polls once the Republicans had stopped their infighting and settled on a nominee. The race between Democrat Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford, who emerged as the Kansas City winner, has narrowed. And what the voters told us in detail indicates possible problems for Carter, even though his lead remains substantial. The president has not gained support. Carter has lost. The number of undecideds has tripled since June, the last CBS News New York Times survey, to 18%. And the increase seems to have come out of the Carter column. Once, most of the voters appeared to have made up their minds. Now, as the Republicans turn from fighting each other to concentrating on the Democratic opponent, more voters appear to be reassessing the former governor of Georgia. It is not, as some have theorized, that Carter's support is softer. Among those who say they strongly favor their candidate, Carter's percentage of support is slightly higher than Mr. Ford's. But a degree of uncertainty does show up when it comes to rating the candidates. On a report card scale ranging from A to F, neither candidate enjoys a high degree of enthusiasm. Both Carter and the president were given an average B-minus grade on honesty and integrity and on ability and competence. Carter, with only 4 years in public office, scored C-plus in experience compared to another B-minus for the president. But in all three of those categories, the significant statistic was the number of don't knows. A steady 7% of those surveyed didn't know about Mr. Ford's honesty, ability, and experience. In Carter's case, it ran between 15 and 16%. The answers appear to indicate that the forthcoming debates could pose more of a test of the Democratic than of the Republican candidate. Carter seemingly has more to prove with the electorate than does the president, who seems to be regarded as more of a known quantity. And Carter will have to be proving himself in areas where the electorate does not seem to be markedly unhappy. Since the Reagan attacks have stopped, the voters now have switched and by a plurality approve of the way Gerald Ford is handling foreign policy. They also think he would do a better job than Carter in handling foreign relations. And while they think Carter would do better in streamlining the government and handling the economy, they still generally think themselves better off than a year ago and approve of the way Mr. Ford is handling the economy. Mr. Ford's approval rating even rose slightly since June, despite 2 months of rising unemployment. But the survey does not reflect the impact of the third monthly increase. Perhaps surprisingly, the one issue that apparently will not have much impact in this fall's campaign debate is abortion, a finding we will take up when we examine more of the voters' views in our next broadcast of Campaign 76. I'm Neil Strauser, CBS News. Campaign 76. I'm Neil Strauser, CBS News, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. On this broadcast, part two of our consideration of the results of the latest CBS News New York Times election survey. We told you earlier that the survey shows Jimmy Carter's commanding majority in June is down to a 4-3 plurality over President Ford in September, with nearly 1 in 5 voters now again undecided, a high number for this stage in the political campaign. In a moment, we'll examine some other findings which may provide some lessons for this Campaign 76.
The survey of 1,703 registered voters was conducted during the week ending September 5th, before Carter's Labor Day campaign kickoff and before the president launched his Stay at the White House incumbency campaign. It probably does not reflect much of the impact of that week's report of the third straight monthly rise in unemployment, nor the full reaction to the abortion issue, which was just peaking. With that in mind, it still appears that one of the lessons may be that Carter should be less concerned about Catholic criticism of his stand on abortion. By almost identical majorities, all voters and those who are Catholic oppose a constitutional amendment to outlaw abortion. Those who favor the amendment still are going for Carter nearly 2-1. There could be some cause for unease, however, from the high 31% still undecided among those who favor the amendment and in a somewhat lowered Catholic support for Carter in the Northeast. Carter might be more concerned about some other findings. For instance, a 55-32% agreement with the statement, "At least I know what kind of President Gerald Ford will be. I'm not so sure about Jimmy Carter." Even Democrats, by a slight majority, agree. The figure is indicating, along with the still relatively high percentage of undecideds in the electorate, that Carter continues to have difficulty getting a clear image across. Nor does it appear that the anti-Washington strategy of basing his campaign in Plains, Georgia, may have the intended effect. The voters have switched, and now by a plurality disagree with the statement, "We should elect someone who has spent most of his political career outside Washington." But lest that encourage President Ford in his incumbency campaign, consider another change. In June, even Democrats came close to agreeing with the statement, "It's a mistake to desert a president who is in office." Now only the Republicans think so. Democrats and independents strongly disagree. The mathematics of voter identification poses the president's greatest problem in retaining office. Only 21% of the voters call themselves Republicans, twice as many Democrats. Mr. Ford must reach out to the third of the electorate which calls itself independent to approach a majority. Independents tend to view themselves as moderates. They're not likely to respond to Mr. Ford's recent use of the abortion issue, but do place heavy emphasis on foreign policy, one of Mr. Ford's strengths, according to the survey. They want more defense spending, are more concerned about inflation and unemployment, and want smaller government, traditional Republican issues. But if Carter wants to catch their attention, he could talk more of streamlining the government. They think he would do a better job of that. They are divided on national health insurance, one of Carter's strongest issues with his own supporters, but apparently would be receptive to a federal jobs program if Carter decides to push that theme. Independents make up the largest share of the undecideds, and they will be the targets in the closing weeks of this Campaign 76. I'm Neil Strauser, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Eric Engberg, CBS News, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. On the campaign trail with Republican vice presidential candidate Robert Dole, you see a tough partisan battler who has been called a hatchet man, but who actually prefers the needle to the hatchet. If President Ford, as has widely been reported, intends to remain above the battle for the early part of the campaign, there's no question about where his running mate Robert Dole will be, in the thick of whatever battles he can drum up. Dole is a reflex partisan, a longtime foot soldier for the GOP whose darts aimed at the Democrats seem to come almost without effort or much forethought. In fact, Dole's own staff concedes that he hasn't yet mastered the craft of delivering an effective speech from a text. He's much better, they feel, when he's in a freewheeling ad-lib situation. And it's in such settings that Dole spins off his harshest characterizations of his opponents. At a press conference in Iowa, he was asked if he didn't think Jimmy Carter would get heavy farm belt support just because he's a farmer.
I don't know whether Jimmy Carter was a farmer or not. I know he inherited a big plantation down there, but they made a great deal of money sharecropping, and I don't know whether that's farming or not. That's when you let somebody else farm it and you take the profit.
This past week, Dole campaigned in South Carolina, where conservatives are a strong political force. Speaking extemporaneously at an airport rally, Dole predicted that his Democratic rival, Walter Mondale, won't be campaigning in the South.
There's a reason you're not going to see that fellow. It's because of his voting record. They don't want to bring Mr. Bussing to the South. They don't want to bring the man down who wants to cut the defense budget year after year after year. They don't want to bring the man down who wants to raise spending by about $9 billion. And I think you'll see very little of Mr. Mondale in the South, and I'm willing to predict that, though I think the prediction itself might bring him to the South. And if it does, he can explain his very, very liberal voting record to South Carolinians and everyone else in the South.
The toughness in Dole's rhetoric has pleased many Republicans, including President Ford, who has told Dole to keep punching. But Dole is also worried about being cast in the role of a mudslinger. So he carefully precedes his attacks with statements that Carter is a fine, decent man, and that Mondale is, quote, my good friend. It may sound deliberately ambiguous, but it is in keeping with Dole's view of politics. He had hoped for a career in athletics before he was wounded in World War II and lost the use of his right arm. And to him, politics is something of an athletic contest. The two sides punch each other around until the whistle sounds, then they shake hands and walk off the field together. That is a different view of politics, Dole feels, than the one embraced by another vice presidential candidate, Spiro Agnew, whose acid attacks often played on social divisions within the country. Dole wants to be tough, but not to be viewed as a man who has been divisive. So he will often leaven his partisan jabs with humor, some of it shaggy dog-type stories, some self-deprecatory one-liners. Explaining how he got on the GOP ticket this year, he says, the president flipped a coin, and it didn't come down. Campaign 76. I'm Eric Engberg, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm David Cohane, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. With the exception of Robert Kennedy, New York's Democrats have not elected a United States Senator since 1950. If you want to know why, just look at what's happening in the Democratic Senate primary here tomorrow. The Democrats in New York State have a margin of nearly a million potential votes in any given election, but somehow they can't seem to win major offices, particularly the Senate. Only Robert Kennedy, something of a ringer from out of state, was able to carry it off. The reason for this is simple. Every 6 years, the Democrats cut each other up so badly in the primary that they can't put it together again in time for the general election. And this year, they may be doing it again. It looked like a Democratic year. There was James Buckley, the man who won his first term in 1970 with only 39% of the vote. Running as a conservative, he beat a Democrat and a Republican. This year, the conservatives and the Republicans endorsed him. Apparently, the Ford Republicans in the state have forgiven him his abortive bid for the presidential nomination in Kansas City this summer. And Buckley is expected to weather a Republican challenge from Congressman Peter Pizer. But Buckley was thought to be vulnerable to any good Democratic candidate. Did the Democrats come up with one good candidate, or maybe two? No, they came up with five, and all five have been battering and bruising each other for the last 2 months. The list of candidates is impressive. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Harvard professor and former ambassador to the United Nations. Congresswoman Bella Abzug, who shaped a record as an effective legislator in her 5 years in the House of Representatives. Former Attorney General Ramsey Clark. New York City Council President Paul O'Dwyer. And finally, millionaire builder Abraham Hirschfeld. Moynihan and Abzug are considered the frontrunners. The problem is that they have all been hammering at each other with a kind of savage vigor that leaves bitterness among the followers of each candidate. Senator Buckley can be seen these days carrying a kind of enigmatic smile on his face, which probably says he thinks he may just get a second term. Now this message.
Hi, this is Count Basie. The jazz you're listening to is more than music. It's the spirit and the soul of an important art that must be preserved. The New York Jazz Museum is trying to keep this soul alive and beating. But it can't be done without your help. So please send your contribution today to New York Jazz Museum, 44 West 63rd Street, New York, New York, 123. Now help preserve the museum and save the soul. Thank you.
Campaign 76, I'm David Culhane for CBS News.
Campaign 76, I'm Bernard Goldberg reporting on the CBS Radio Network. This is the season for political polls, and one just out shows Jimmy Carter substantially ahead of Gerald Ford in seven deep southern states. But the poll concludes, there are indications that Carter's southern support is eroding. In the words of pollster Claiborne Darden of Atlanta, it appears that Jimmy Carter has placed himself too far to the left to make most southern voters happy. The poll was conducted by the Darden Research Corporation between September 4th and 8th of potential voters in Florida, Georgia, Alabama, North Carolina, South Carolina, Mississippi, and Tennessee. The margin of error is said to be plus or minus 4 points. 600 persons were surveyed by telephone, and Jimmy Carter was picked by 53.5% of them, compared to 31.8% for Gerald Ford.
American Independent Party candidate Lester Maddox was favored by 1%, and nearly 14% were undecided. Darden says, classically, the first indication of changing voter patterns is seen in the preferences of the independent voter. And according to the survey, candidate Ford has the majority of the Southern independent vote, 53.5%. Darden also says that while a majority of those surveyed say they favor Carter, many seem more aligned with Gerald Ford on some basic issues, like Vietnam pardons and compulsory federally financed national health insurance. 61% are against granting a pardon to Vietnam War draft resistors and Army deserters. Carter says he would issue pardons, but not amnesty, to draft resistors. Ford opposes blanket amnesty and pardons. And 47% say they oppose compulsory national health insurance, while just under 40% favor such a plan. The Republican platform opposes it. The Democratic platform favors it. Darden's opinion that Carter has placed himself too far to the left for Southern taste is based in part on Carter's selection of Walter Mondale, a liberal, as his running mate. Says Darden, Carter didn't have to pick Mondale. He just needed to be one step to the left of Ford. You get too far over, Darden says, and you lose the right and the South. His conclusion? Even though Carter is leading, there is still a chance for a good horse race in the South. Campaign 76. I'm Bernard Goldberg reporting on the CBS Radio Network.
Campaign 76. I'm Christopher Glenn reporting on the CBS Radio Network. It costs a lot to run an airplane, and in the presidential campaigns, no one gets a free ride. Reporters and Secret Service agents who fly on Peanut One or Jimmy Carter's other charter aircraft have kicked in almost a third of the $440,000 the planes have cost so far. But that's not enough, says Carter's staff. They want the reporters and agents to chip in for the cost of vacant seats, too. It may seem that the Carter staff is nickel and diming it, but it's come down to that this year. No more lush press parties, no more big bucks. If you're a fat cat itching to give a spare million to your presidential choice, you have to think long and hard how to do it. You're a millionaire Texas oilman, and you're at a cocktail party. A highly placed worker for one of the presidential hopefuls is there, too. And over the punch bowl, he begins to muse. Gee, he says, it sure would be nice to cover Texas with a million-dollar broadcast campaign, but we don't have the dough. Aha, you think, here's your chance to help your candidate. So after your cocktail, you hightail it back to Dallas and order up the slickest 30-second spots ever played over Texas airwaves. And you're an angel, right? Wrong. The new campaign law says individual contributors can spend what they want only if they do not consult with the official campaign staff. But you say, surely that comment over the punch bowl wasn't a consultation, right? Wrong. The law says it was, and that $1 million advertising bill will be charged off against the candidate's campaign fund just as if he'd spent it himself. And that's the problem. Campaign chests are no longer bottomless receptacles, chewing up dollars and grinding out radio and TV spots, parties and balloons, bags, buttons, and bumper stickers. The new law says each campaign can spend only $21.8 million, part of the wad in the federal treasury built up from the dollar checkoff on your income tax return. Now, $21.8 million ain't hay, but it ain't much either. Compare the $30 million George McGovern spent on his presidential campaign last time around. Put that $30 million into the inflation mill, turn the crank, and you'd have to spend about $40 million this year to equal the kind of money McGovern spent. That's about twice as much as this year's limit. And McGovern lost. Okay, so if you, the rich activist, want to spend your money, you have to do it in the blind, buying $1 million worth of Gerry Ford shopping bags or Jimmy Carter peanut keychains, but without asking or telling anyone on their staff in advance. A risky business when you'd like to buy a bit of influence along with your bumper stickers. Well, you can give up to $20,000, small change, we admit, to the GOP or Democratic National Committee, but you have no idea how they'd spend it. The committee could use the money for voter registration or for a local congressman you hate. A far cry from the days when you could dump your dollars right where you wanted to, hoping for some small favor from the winner at a later date. The new campaign financing law was designed to eliminate the advantage enjoyed by candidates with access to big money, and the law seems to be working. Campaign 76. I'm Christopher Glenn, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Phil Jones, CBS News White House correspondent, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. candidate Gerald Ford has officially launched his campaign in a one-day trip to Michigan. And with that done, he's back home at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, exploiting what he already has that his Democratic opponent doesn't, the presidential incumbency. By now, the American voters have been able to observe that candidate Gerald Ford's campaign strategy is, at this point, very simple. Try in every way to look like the president, the incumbent. One way to do this is to stay around the White House lots, which is exactly what Mr. Ford is doing. Well, is this stay-at-home strategy working? The president and his key strategists say yes. They point to how Mr. Ford improved in the public opinion polls during the first 2 weeks of the campaign while he was right here at home tending to business, and Jimmy Carter was on the campaign trail spending lots of time and lots of money. But Ford aides know that this staying at home cannot last. Why? Well, for numerous reasons, which include daily press coverage that always seems to show that Mr. Ford is avoiding the campaign trail. Local candidates are beginning to complain because the Republican at the top of the ticket this year is not out there so they can stand beside him, although it should be noted that some Republican candidates are not particularly anxious to hang on to Mr. Ford's coattails. Also, the subtle campaigning from the White House is not, as Vice President Rockefeller has pointed out, generating the enthusiasm that is needed for a candidate who is behind in all the public opinion polls. And finally, Democratic presidential nominee Jimmy Carter has started talking about how, as Carter puts it, Mr. Ford is hiding in the White House to avoid the issues. So, come next month, you can expect to see Mr. Ford on the road a good share of the time. But, in the meantime, the Ford stay-at-home strategy has accomplished two objectives. It has saved thousands of dollars, which can be spent for the crucial last few weeks of the campaign, and it has kept candidate Ford away from the hectic campaign travel grind, which often results in candidates making serious blunders. This has been Campaign 76. I'm Phil Jones, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Miriam Bier, reporting from Los Angeles on the CBS Radio Network. The Carter-Ford race in California, surprisingly close. California's 45 electoral votes are one-sixth of those needed to win, and it's a state heavily Democratic in registration. But in the last 40 years, California's electoral votes were cast in the Democratic column only twice. The popularity of Ronald Reagan shows the independence of Californians. They crossed party lines in huge numbers to elect him governor. Many Reagan partisans came home from the Kansas City Convention angry over their man's defeat. But GOP ranks have closed quickly. Bob Neeson was the Reagan delegation chairman. Now he's state co-chairman of the Ford Dole campaign. Neeson says the California race now is too close to call, so the broadcast debates will be crucial, and the conversion of Reagan forces ensures effective grassroots.
When we could put the 58 counties together in about 3 days, I think that's pretty good unity. It was just amazing. We didn't believe it. Of course, the Ford side was absolutely amazed because they didn't think that we would be able to pull this together. And I'm very happy with what has happened.
Democrats agree the race will be tight. Terry O'Connell, brought in from Jimmy Carter's Atlanta organization to run the California effort, guesses Carter is 10 percentage points ahead. He concedes the GOP has the edge in unity. Rumors are circulating that Carter has alienated political and financial supporters by bringing in non-Californians. But there are some bright spots for Carter. Independent Eugene McCarthy apparently won't be on the ballot to draw off liberal votes. And O'Connell says a former rival, Governor Edmund Brown Jr., will be a willing ally.
He has an amazingly terrific ability to track me down everywhere I am going and telling me to get moving and get working and get some excitement in the campaign. And he's also very creative in giving me some ideas to do that. And I think that we're going to see the results of those pretty soon. I am trying to get up to his speed.
Campaign 76. I'm Miriam Bier for CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Sharon Lovejoy, CBS News, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. Jimmy Carter takes an old-fashioned whistle-stop train trip in search of Democratic votes. Jimmy Carter usually travels from one campaign appearance to another on his charter plane Peanut One. But today, he's aboard the Democratic whistle-stop, riding a 12-car train through three eastern states, speaking from an old-fashioned rear platform draped in red, white, and blue bunting. Carter's staff says the reason for the whistle-stop tour is twofold: to change his campaign style a bit and to create a new excitement among the voters. Carter likes to tell the crowds that he's following in the footsteps of Harry Truman. He, too, spoke to the people from the back of a train and enjoyed great success with that technique. But there are some political experts who say that Carter is riding the victory express because his opponent, President Ford, gained political ground during his whistle-stop tour in Michigan in the primary. From all indications, the Carter whistle-stop strategy seems to be working. Large, friendly crowds are waiting at each stop, ready to cheer as Carter launches into his standard campaign speech. He consistently attacks the Republican record of the past 8 years, blaming the Ford administration for increased taxes, high inflation, and even higher unemployment figures. Carter tries at every stop to present the image of a fiscal conservative who can balance the budget, as well as a compassionate leader who will deliver jobs and public service programs if elected. That's not an easy task, and it's hard to tell if his message is getting through to the voters. They cheer in all the right spots, but many of them seem more interested in watching the news media work, waving their hands of homemade signs in front of the television cameras, than in Carter's promise for a better government under his administration. On the surface, the whistle-stop trip seems to be a media event, planned for maximum exposure. But the train has given Jimmy Carter a chance to talk to large groups of voters under favorable conditions, free from the crowd of reporters which sometimes separates him from the people. And it just may convince some voters that Carter is what he seems to want to be, a modern-day Harry Truman. Campaign 76, I'm Sharon Lovejoy, CBS News.